You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful, warm, well, cool. Well, Don, is it winter yet?
Not quite freezing out there, but I did have a very light frost this morning at ground level. So we dropped down to the mid-30s. It was about 37 when I got up. Right now it's 44 degrees. It is Wednesday, January 19th, as we record this version of the Davis Garden Show, which will broadcast on Thursday, January 20, 2022. High temperature today, as we record, this will be 59 degrees, and it will drop down to 38 degrees tonight with mostly clear conditions, patchy fog in the morning. Here are the highs for the next 5 days. Thursday, 59. Friday, 63. Saturday, 62. Sunday, 60 degrees. Monday, 59 degrees. Monday night, 38. Tuesday, 60 degrees. Night temperatures, mostly 37, 38, 40 degrees throughout that period. We have a very strong high pressure ridge blocking any storms that would be coming over us. And so there's going to be some light and variable wind from the north Thursday night. Looks like they'll start Thursday afternoon, but we're talking about gusts to 23 miles an hour. Now, those of you who live here know that's a normal north wind, not the kind of thing you need to be particularly concerned about, but it will be breezy on Friday from the north, which means probably pretty clear that night, then some clouds moving in briefly Friday night, and then just sunny is the extended forecast all the way through. We've got this high pressure ridge is quite stable, or I had to look it up, the EPAC high, as they like to say at the National Weather Service extended discussion format. I'm going, EPAC, what does that stand for? Eastern Pacific, that's where we are. Eastern Pacific high ridge remains the dominant synoptic feature throughout the extended period Sunday through Wednesday, which will result in continued dry weather with above normal high temperatures in the low 60s for the most part, with lighter wind expected, patchy night and morning fog possible in parts of the Central Valley. So sunny, a little bit warmer than average, basically 4 to 5 degrees warmer than average. Got a question about chilling hours. Someone in a orchard group on social media posted a picture of a peach tree that she had bought at a nursery in Sacramento, which required 750 to 800 chilling hours. And then she said, I don't think we get that much here, do we? I'm concerned about this. Here in Davis, I have been tracking chilling hours now for a couple of decades. We average about 800 to 850 chilling hours in the Davis, mm-hmm, Woodland-Dixon area per year. So to answer that person's question, you're fine. That peach will be just fine. We know we're talking about a somewhat antiquated method of assessing how well a tree is going to do, because we've moved on from chilling hours to chilling portions. But I will tell you that at the start of this season, we had a warm fall and we went into December quite warm and sunny. And at the first several weeks of chilling hour tracking, we were at the lowest level I had seen in more than 15 years. If you go to the UC Davis fruitsandnuts.ucdavis.edu website and click through the links to the new URLs they've created, you will find this data going back for as long as they've been tracking it at Davis and all the way back to the early 1990s, I believe. And I had to go back 15 years to find a year that started out as slowly in terms of accumulating chilling hours. But here's an interesting phenomenon. We've often talked about the difference between chilling hours and chilling portions. The chilling portions model takes into account spikes of very high temperature, such as you might experience down in Southern California, as you do experience in Southern California, where in January, even December, it can be in the 70s for a couple of days and then go back down to what are more normal winter temperatures for you. We know that that is more harmful to a fruit tree's dormancy than the actual total accumulation of hours. The accumulation of hours gives you a rough guide to how well a particular variety is going to do. It's disrupted by the extremes, particularly high temperature extremes, during the dormancy period. We've had an unusually stable winter in terms of temperatures here. And I believe that's true in many other parts of California. We've had our valley fog, which keeps it cold, cool if you prefer, well into the morning, so that it doesn't, so we get a number of chilling actual hours more than we do if it's just gets sunny right away and warms up during the daytime. Temperatures in the 60s and above are not helping the tree's dormancy, and in fact seem to be undoing some of the previous dormancy. We haven't had that much of that until literally this week. We've had what a lot of old timers keep mentioning to me, and as someone who I guess now has become close to being an old timer, we're having winters like we used to have. We're having the kind of thing we remember when it was really foggy here in December to the point of being dangerous to drive, when there would be day after day of fog and overcast, keeping the temperatures, the high temperatures, subdued. And so we're on track for approximately 850 chilling hours for this year at the rate things are going. Very high likelihood that we'll get there. And that's plenty for anything you're buying at any local garden center that at least correctly buys their stock. I mean, I do sometimes go on a rant about the things I see at places that aren't really nurseries, where they will sell varieties that I think are inappropriate. But that's really more of an issue, more of a concern for those of you listening in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Central Coast, or especially Southern California. Very important to know if you live in, let's say, San Diego County, you can range from 50 chilling hours total where my parents lived right on the coast to a few hundred chilling hours just 10 or 15 miles inland because of the extraordinary difference in coastal influences you get down there. And so you need to know what your local chilling hours are. And one of the simplest way to find that is to go to fruitsandnuts.ucdavis.edu. When you get there, a big old banner is going to come up that this site is still under construction. Look for weather tools or weather models. Click on that. It'll get you where you need to go. And it's very interesting to look at those totals and how they differ all over California. Even within just seemingly a few miles of between two weather stations, you can get a pretty significant difference in chilling hours. In the Sacramento Valley, we get 750 to 850 chilling hours consistently and reliably. You noted that the very first one I recorded there was less than 600. That's happened in the years I've been here two or three times, and it did have some impact on certain stone fruit crops, apricots notably, cherries one year, where we didn't get the chilling hours they needed, and the fruit set and the yield was substantially lower. Not a big deal for a home gardener if it happens once or twice every 30 years or so, but obviously if you're a farmer, that would be a concern. And of course, the next question that typically comes up is, well, what about, you know, climate change, winter's getting warmer, should I be concerned about this? And the simple answer is, not within the lifespan of that tree you're about to plant. Yes, in the long run, it is fully expected, and I've seen well-established models published in peer-reviewed journals that we would probably lose, let's say, 20% or so of our chilling hours by the turn of the century, okay, by the turn of the century, a number of years down the road. But the lifespan of a fruit tree is 15 to 25 years. So we aren't going to be dropping so low in chilling hours on a regular basis over the next decade, two decades, three decades that you need to be concerned about that variety you're purchasing. Your children may be choosing and planting different varieties than you are. As time goes along, lower chill varieties will become more appropriate. For those who are concerned about it, there are some very good low chill varieties, meaning ones that can fruit well with less chilling hours, of practically everything. And so if you're listening in San Diego County, Los Angeles area, the Bay Area, and you know that you've only got 300, 400 chilling hours, you do have good varieties. You have the Santa Barbara peach, the Red Baron peach, which we grow here. They only need a couple hundred chilling hours. There are now cherry varieties, if you happen to want to try and grow sweet cherries, that only need 400 chilling hours. These are not commercial varieties. There's one or a reason or so that they wouldn't necessarily become ones you'll see in grocery stores, but they're great home garden varieties. So don't just buy a fruit tree at a place that doesn't seem like they know what they're talking about, I guess is the best way I can put this. You know, you go into a place where they've got a display of fruit trees and they're a hardware store and they don't seem to have any answers to your questions. And you better read those labels pretty carefully. But the good news is, it'll almost always say right on the label, 600 hours, 700 hours, something like that. So know what your chilling hours are and purchase your varieties accordingly.
I have a couple of questions about chilling hours. One is, you're calling them chilling hours. Now, does that mean that it's going to be 54 high today and 33 tonight? Mm-hmm. And so if it's above 45 degrees for, you know, 6 hours in the middle of the day and the rest of the time is below that, does that mean we get, what, 18 chilling hours today?
You actually count the number of hours between 32 and 45 degrees. And
above. So literally hours.
Literally hours. Now that's, again, I've said that we've moved on to a chilling portions model, which reflects the fact that above 60, you start losing the benefits of that chilling. And so that's, and by the way, from chilling portions, we've been fine the whole season. This is an interesting difference. I go through this. I have a couple of customers who are, you know, raised fruit and nuts for a living. They're farmers. So they follow this very, very closely. And we chat about chilling hours and chilling portions quite regularly, figuring out where to track them, where I'm getting my information versus where they're getting their information. And on chilling portions, one of them is a pistachio nut farmer in this area. He has a lot of acreage in pistachio nuts. The male pistachio is said to need about 900 chilling hours. That's a concern because we average 850. Well, pistachio growers in the Sacramento Valley have found the male trees flower just fine, even when we get less than what was thought to be the necessary chilling hours, so long as they get the right chilling portions. So you're not going to see a lot of pistachio nut trees going in even in interior Southern California, but it's turning out to be a great tree for the valley. However, as we've discussed many times, this gentleman and I, in the long run, I'm hoping that there's some agricultural researchers out there working on lower chill male pistachio varieties, because that's going to be important. And pistachio nut trees, by the way, can live 30, 40, 50 years. So if you're planting a pistachio orchard and you're younger than your mid-60s, you may wish to consider keeping an eye out for newer low chill varieties as they come along. And they will. They, you know, if it's a lucrative crop, you can bet there's an ag researcher out there working on a lower chill cultivar of male pistachio. And they're out there. I've read about them.
When you have something, you buy something that's a low chill variety, and then you end up with a 1200 chilling hours, is that going to damage the plant?
The only issue is if it's a low chill, then the need for chilling hours will be satisfied early. And if you are prone to late season frost in your area, if you have areas where there's fluctuating weather, I understand this is a problem in the peach regions of Texas, for example, where it warms up and then it cools off again. It warms up and it cools off again. They can have frost later in these areas than we do typically here. Well, if it gets the hours it needs and breaks dormancy and blooms and there's cold weather, colder than is optimal, like cold enough to damage the blossoms, that can obviously affect the crop if you damage the blossoms. I have a lilac, and lilacs, people don't think about non-fruiting plants as having chilling hours requirements, but some do. Yeah, some do. Lilacs in particular, the sweet smelling lilac of your childhood requires a certain number of chilling hours, and they're variable, actually. Most of them require 600, 700, 800 chilling hours. We get that here. In Davis, lilacs do great. When I give talks on flowering shrubs and things, I always show some. Someone in the audience is always surprised to learn that we can grow lilacs and have them bloom successfully in this area. And there's two answers to that. One is that there's a whole series that were introduced by the Descanso Gardens of Southern California for their low chill bloom. And they will bloom even in Southern California, the Descanso hybrids. But even common hybrid French lilacs, the best known ones from back east, will grow and bloom adequately here in the valley. I know this because when we bought our place, there were several on the property. So I've just kept adding more. I think it's great. They're one of the easiest, most low care flowering shrubs you can come up with if you have enough sunlight for them. Other than, you know, they're drought tolerant. They actually like a higher pH than most plants. I'm told that in some places they actually lime the soils to grow lilacs, but we sure don't have to worry about that here. And I have about 15 of them now that bloom very nicely. I have one very low chill one, which is trying to bloom right now. And I have, remember, this is January. I have pictures of it when it bloomed in the late fall one year. And that messes it up. It blooms early and they don't develop properly. And I may not get around to it. I'm probably going to just take that one out because it doesn't give a very satisfactory bloom when it's supposed to bloom. It gets the trigger early and it thinks it's time to bloom this year in the, you know, third week of January. And they don't really develop properly. So you want to have fruit trees that are appropriate to your region. Locally, people will know. It will say on the label, I'm mentioning that chilling portions are more contemporary model than chilling hours, but chilling hours is what's on the label. And as one researcher put it to us, it's still a reasonable proxy for what you're after. Is this going to flower properly, set fruit, yield well in our area with the kinds of winters that we have?
I wanted to ask you a little bit about lilacs. Now, I know that if you have them in sun, they're happy. If you put them in shade, they're mildewy. You mentioned that some need more chilling hours and less hours and stuff. And that low chilling hour one that is trying to bloom in January, what would happen if you cut off the buds at the buds start form at the end of the flowering season.
The flower so buds.
If those were cut off, would the next year it make buds before it blossomed, or would just not have any flowers at all?
You probably won't have any at all. They set their flower buds, and this goes for most of your fruit trees, as I understand it, in the late summer. The flower buds differentiate in late summer as the tree is getting ready to go into the first phase of dormancy, when it's not growing but hasn't dropped its leaves yet, is apparently when flower buds differentiate. And they may trigger to bloom quite early. The year that that lilac bloomed in October, it didn't bloom in the spring. So it used up the flower buds that were there. I took pictures of it. It smelled great. It was kind of cool having a lilac in October, but it's a little disappointing if that your expectation was to have it blooming at the traditional time of year. By the way, I have other Descanso hybrids and they do just fine. So I'm not sure what it is with this particular one, but it might be a great choice for, I don't know, coastal San Diego. Lilacs will take full sun with no problem. They will take shade, and your experience has probably been the same as mine. The more shade they're in, the more mildew you get on the leaves. You know what? Yeah. They still bloom, interestingly. I have one that is now, I've been meaning to move it, but it's so well established that it would be a huge undertaking. And it blooms great every year. And by the middle of the summer, because it's in the complete shade of an oak tree, the leaves look white with powdery mildew, but it grows fine and it flowers fine where it is. I just don't really care. But it wouldn't be very satisfactory to most people to plant a lilac in significant amounts of shade. And speaking of them, there's a lot of different kinds. Wherever you're listening, there's probably a type of lilac that you can grow. It may just not be the absolutely familiar kind if you grew up in, I don't know, the Midwest or the Mid-Atlantic or New England or places like that.
Well, I actually have a very old lilac, had a very old lilac that was right next to the sidewalk and was under that xylosma bush that got cut down last year.
How's it doing?
No, it's coming out. Oh. but I planted that other lilac, which doesn't look at all like a lilac. It's a, I'm forgetting the name again.
No, there's the genus is Syringa. And in Syringa, there's a lot of lilacs that are different species. Syringa vulgaris is the common lilac, right, or French hybrid lilac. And there are thousands of varieties of French hybrid lilacs. But there's other species, Hungarian lilacs. There's quite a lot. And some of them bloom very readily, even in mild winter areas. They don't all have the same fragrance that we're thinking of. You know, they don't necessarily all have that wonderful sweet smell that your French hybrids have. But many of them do have a very pleasant scent as well. And generally speaking, in California, lilacs are pretty indestructible garden plants.
Is there something called an evergreen lilac?
No, but there's a reblooming lilac that came on the market with considerable fanfare. If you've got an evergreen thing called a lilac, you probably got a ceanothus.
No, actually I don't.
But you know, you know,
the little cut leaf lilac. What's
Persian.
That one?
Oh, that's the Persian lilac.
That's it. I put in a Persian lilac bush. And yeah, so we're going to see if that works.
That will work. I think it's either an Arboretum All-Star or one of their featured plants. And it's a big plant. It's very informal. It doesn't bloom at the end of the growth like the French hybrid lilac does. It blooms all along the branch with smaller blooms. So it's not as showy all at once, but it's got a longer bloom season, very pleasant fragrance. And the biggest version of that I've ever seen was about 12 by 12. So it can become a very large plant, but you can prune lilacs, as you know, for size control with no problem. I want to mention an open garden event. This is the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center navigating its way through the pandemic and trying to continue educating the public. It's out in Fair Oaks on Fair Oaks Boulevard. Fair Oaks Horticulture Center is, let me get the actual official address for you here, is on 11549 Fair Oaks Boulevard, and they're having an open garden on January 22nd, 9 a.m. to noon. The UC Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners of Sacramento County, who manage that garden, will be there to answer your questions. It's informal, free event. You can roam the gardens, watch what they're doing, see what they're growing, ask questions, bring samples of pest problems, mystery pests, questions, get one-on-one advice, appropriately socially distanced, based on the most recent research-based sustainable practices. This is a great opportunity, they say here, and I agree, to observe winter at the Horticulture Center. Why would you want to go to a fruit garden in the winter to see how they're training and pruning the trees and all these different methods they have. Multi-graft, three-in-one hole, summer pruned, vase pruned, all the different training techniques for different trees, how you can pack a whole lot of fruit in your backyard. Well, they have examples out there at the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center. The Master Gardeners will be available in all areas of the garden to demonstrate proper pruning methods, the importance of pruning for deciduous fruit trees, blueberries, caneberries, and grapevines, as well as shade trees. You can visit the High Density Demonstration Orchard to find out how you can grow a wide variety of fruits that provide prolonged harvest in a limited space landscape. Green thumbs can shine in small yards. Learn how, they say. So that is January 22nd, 9 a.m. to noon, January Open Garden at the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center on Fair Oaks Boulevard. For more information, go somewhere. I'll get you the link. Get you the link in just a moment here. Oh, you can go to the link for the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center. There you go.
Yeah,
and we'll get you a map, and that would probably be important. It's off Zinfandel. Okay.
So one of the things you might do is, if you have a magnifying glass, take it along and ask the Master Gardeners to show you how the various fruit trees have differentiated between their fruiting buds and their leaf buds, and how you can tell, and so you aren't going to be pruning off the wrong thing in the middle of the winter. It's fun to take a magnifying glass with you.
And one of the most important things that you will learn is which trees fruit on all down the branch, like peaches and nectarines, and which ones fruit on short spurs, a little fruiting wood that develops like on apples and cherries, and lasts, they fruit in the same spot year after year. And I was always very amused by the customer who was quite an expert in terms of growing certain other crops, wasn't getting any fruit on his cherry, Finally, I went out there to look at it because he'd had this tree for 5 or 6 years and there was no fruit on it. And I looked and someone had methodically, very systematically pruned out all of the spurs. And his wife was standing there and I said, did somebody cut all these little short shoots out here? He goes, yeah, I did that. I've heard that you should thin your fruit trees and make them more open. I said, well, don't take this the wrong way. His wife sort of folded her arms and I said, but you just cut off all the fruiting wood off your cherry.
Thinning means something else. Yeah.
Thinning refers to those upright shoots, taking them out, crossing branches, things like that. So one of the first things you learn if you take courses in fruit tree pruning and anything like that is where they fruit, where that particular species fruits. Is it a spur fruiting or is it like a peach or nectarine where it fruits all down last year's wood and so forth? That determines how you prune it.
Hey, you and some of them are both, like my plum. It starts out all down the new growth, and the old growth has spurs.
Plums are actually an interesting case in point. I've often said that plums are probably one of the easiest fruit trees that a backyard gardener can grow. If you've decided you're going to jump into fruit trees in the backyard, you don't have to thin a plum. The fruit will just be smaller. You don't absolutely have to prune it, at least in its first several years. It'll still fruit well, and the quantity will be fine, and the quality will be okay. The best advice I've seen came from a publication from Oregon State years ago, which simply said, you prune plums harder the longer you have them. And the reason for that being, they will fruit more and more and more, as you've noted, on these spurs, as well as down the branches to some degree. And at some point, you'll have a year like this, where it's beautiful and sunny. And let's say that happens when the plum is blooming and it's in full bloom and you got great bee activity, you'll get so much fruit that the tree will start to collapse here and there. And if you aren't good at thinning fruit, which nobody is, honestly, then you'll have limb breakage. And limb breakage is, I hate to say, kind of the beginning of the end for most fruit trees. When branches start breaking, you start getting problems. So the pruning on plums typically is just to tamp down the yield more than anything, and make the fruit accessible. So it's a sort of extreme example of the two basic principles that we're saying to home gardeners that they don't use in orchards. Reduce your fruit load, keep the trees small. All that's counterintuitive to someone who thinks, well, but that will reduce my yield. You know what your yield is on a Santa Rosa plum?
I know how many 100 pounds were donated to that charity group. After we had picked all we could eat in the neighborhood, they came in and got hundreds of pounds of fruit.
Yeah, that's great if you want that, but most of us aren't really canning and preserving. And so what you did is, by the way, one of the best things you can do.
Yeah.
Contact your local food bank and say, I don't know what to do with them all. Do you have someone out there that will harvest them? So with
respect, and do that 2 months before you think you're going to be harvesting, because in Davis we have so many fruit trees that they get swamped with requests, and you know, it's tough. And now with the pandemic, it's they don't have as many crews to take to go out and stuff. So,
So the harder pruning is really an important part of that. And you don't, but the good news is, like we're saying with plums, you don't absolutely have to do it. Whereas if you don't do it with a peach, I can guarantee the tree is going to start falling apart. All right. Your husband sent us a great article this time, as he often does. And this is from the Washington Post about how to move houseplants. And I read through it, and I'd say I'd like to make one really important point. It's January. Moving houseplants, the most risky aspect of moving houseplants is that it's January. And this time of year, movers, actually, many of them won't even move houseplants, I believe the article says. Yes, many companies don't move houseplants because of the risk of damage. So if you're planning to hire professionals, ask about their policy beforehand. Some of them will agree to move plants if you agree not to hold them responsible for potential trauma from extreme weather or bumpy roads. And now, the bumpy roads are less of a concern because you can pack a tree, you can pack houseplants. I've helped people through this process. Just essentially wrap them with a blanket or something like that, lay them on their side so they don't fall onto their side, stack them carefully so they don't jostle around a lot. That's all pretty easy to do. But as you're driving across the country, and you get out of that truck and you head in to have lunch at a Denny's somewhere, and it's in Fort Collins, Colorado, and it's 12 degrees below zero. I don't know if it gets 12 degrees below zero in Fort Collins. That's not going to be good for your houseplants. So exposure to low temperatures is extremely problematic for tropical plants, and almost all of your houseplants are tropical plants. So if your mover agrees to haul the houseplants, make sure they won't be left in the truck overnight once it arrives. The author says some companies will keep them in a climate controlled space, such as an office, if a drop off is not scheduled for a few days. But boy, you better check that out in advance.
Have that
in advance in writing if necessary.
And the next one is also very important. It says research your destination.
Yeah.
And that's because houseplants are, they're just in your house, right? But some houseplants are under quarantine. So you can't move, for example, you can't move citrus plants into California from someplace else. And so you want to take care of that. And then if you're going to do it yourself, you make sure that you in your car with your houseplants have it comfortable for them.
Yes. You recommend checking the weather for your route and planning accordingly. Your car's heating or air conditioning, by the way, summer is just as much of an issue, should be enough to keep plants healthy when you're driving. But if you need to stop for the night and conditions are below freezing or are sweltering hot, you'll need to plan to bring the plants inside. So the bottom line is just move in the spring or the fall. Okay. Moving in summer and winter, it just isn't going to work because these are tropical plants.
And even if you are moving in summer and winter, you still need to prepare your plants for the move, because they may be, you know, boxed up and in conditions that are not good for them. So you don't want them to be drying out or
I'm going to correct that. One thing your mover probably won't know is that plants are less vulnerable to mechanical injury when they're a little on the dry side. So letting them go a little bit, they lose their turgor. And so letting them go a little bit dry, don't take this to extremes, but actually moving them a little dry can be better in terms of reducing just the kind of injury from jostling around. If you do need to know about whether you can bring something into, let's say, California, and the states that are most concerned about this, other than Hawaii, where you obviously won't be driving, California, Arizona, Texas, Florida, states that have significant citrus industries in particular, but it's not just the citrus. You can call the county agricultural commissioner, the county ag commissioner, anywhere you are, and they will either know what the rules are for where you're going or know who to contact for the rules for where you're going. And they're incredibly helpful people. So when people ask me, and it's often way beyond just this, can I move something? I'm coming to Davis to go to college. Can I bring my Meyer lemon tree with me? My answer is no, give it to your friend and buy a new one when you get here. But there are ways to do it, but you have to get a phytosanitary certificate. That's complicated. They don't want you bringing in soil is the primary thing in most cases. Yeah. So if you are bringing something in, you might need to actually literally bare root it, which can be done, but it's a stress on a lot of plants. And so if it's a plant that you just have a nostalgic attachment to, well, go through those steps, but it may well be that it's simpler, as I said, just to give it away or sell it where you are and buy a new one where you're moving to. But your county agricultural commissioner or farm advisor, if you're in rural areas, will probably know the answers or know who to contact about what is needed and what the rules are in your destination. I get this all the time with people asking about sending things from Davis out of the country to another country. I had a customer whose mother lived in Haiti and actually had a farm in Haiti and wanted to send her citrus. Boy, that's a complicated question. They don't have access to good citrus varieties there. There's not a robust nursery industry in Haiti. And she was curious about getting citrus sent there. And I said, well, I'll tell you, the Ag Commissioner could give you general guidance. Obviously, the agricultural division of the government of Haiti might be able to help you, though I understand things are a little chaotic there. The one in this case, contacting, since citrus is one of the most common ways, this, in instances where this question comes up, there are citrus growers that sell by mail, such as Four Winds Growers, and they will know because you can see right on their website, cannot ship to blah, blah, blah. Shipping overseas varies from country to country. So that's, again, well, the vendor can help you on that. I'm talking about an established, legitimate vendor, not some group on Etsy, okay, an actual nursery that has done this before. They can give you the information, but the Ag Commissioner or the Ag Department of the receiving country can also give you information. It's hard to do. I don't really recommend this, but I've had really interesting conversations from with people from Haiti and another woman from Somalia who wanted to send fruit trees and get fruit trees going where she was from. And I just guided her towards the USDA and the California Department of Agriculture, and our local Ag Commissioner turned out to be a great, great resource for that.
And understand that you're living here in Davis. You want to send your plant, your tree to Somalia. Well, you know, you don't have to do that. No. You can buy on mail order a tree to have it delivered there. Then you don't have to deal with the packing, the shipping, all that stuff. And it's much easier and it's probably a lot cheaper.
In the long run, in that one, we won't go too much further into this topic, but there are ways you can buy budwood. You can buy scion wood for grafting at the other end. And you can buy disease-free budwood from the citrus research station down in Southern California. So it is free of diseases and can be shipped. Now you're paying for each little branch, and there's been a lot of grumbling because they bumped the prices up on that. You're not getting any roots. You're getting a branch with buds on it. And when that arrives, you can either graft it or you can take the several buds that are on the stick and bud each one of those. That's a safe way to go. So if you're really seriously thinking about starting a citrus orchard in Somalia, Haiti, or some other country, which is a virtually great idea in terms of getting self-reliance and introducing some varieties that might broaden the diet and so on, that would be the way to do it. We don't want to see soil going places, and we want disease and pest-free things going places. So there's ways to do that, and one of the simplest is to transfer scion wood rather than soil. Okay, that was way off topic.
I want to go one more step off topic.
Okay,
let's say in Haiti, and they have some citrus there, and you're bringing in a different new variety species. Do you have to worry about the fact that it is not native?
Yes, well, citrus are not native there. And so we're talking about a crop. There are plants you don't want to go shipping around, and it would be wise to investigate invasive plant potential. There are excellent databases online of invasive plants by region.
Mm-hmm. Okay, back to the article. It talks about how to box up your plants and how to deal with pests in the plants and how to load your vehicle and how to unbox them and all that sort of stuff. Good article. Washington Post frequently has good gardening articles. So my husband, thank you, Jim, sends them to us.
So we get some great notes from our listeners out there, and we love this one from Holly. Lois, I think you have that one in front of you.
I do. You want me to read it? Are you sure you want me to read it?
Oh, yes, I do.
Okay.
Let me back up here. At my garden center, there is a wanted poster on the bulletin board behind the counter. And on the wanted poster, I didn't put dead or alive because we don't want them dead. Wanted poster has a picture of a white-crowned sparrow on it. Now, if you're a longtime listener to the Davis Garden Show, you may be aware that I have a slight animosity towards that name.
Oh, slight animosity then?
Well, it's cute, and it tries to make up for being cute and get away with a lot of stuff. Anyway, go ahead and read this. This is great.
Okay, so Holly is one of our longtime listeners. Thank you, Holly, for all the correspondence you've done over the years. It really is a joy to hear from you. Well, usually. Hi, Don and Lois. I have a little story for you that I think you'll both find amusing, but probably for slightly different reasons. I live on a 1/3 acre in Redlands, California, in what I would call a fairly sterile suburban environment. When we moved in, there were barely any birds and maybe only one lizard here and there. So I embarked on a campaign to build a better and more balanced ecosystem by creating habitat, planting natives, etc. The guard finally reached a point where there's enough cover to protect birds from the neighborhood cats, so I put in a couple of bird baths recently. To my delight, the bird population exploded. Well, even good things have consequences. Until this week, I had never seen a white-crowned sparrow in my yard. Well, you know where this is going. Yesterday, I had a whole flock in my vegetable garden all over my raised beds. I was in Don's many warnings did cross my mind, but I admit that I didn't dismiss them because most of my veggies are too mature to be harmed. Silly me. I forgot about my latest round of beet seedlings. When I went out afterward to check on things, my beet seedlings were completely gone, and all that was left were tiny telltale bird droppings. Sigh. I guess I'll be re-sowing under some wire mesh later today. I still think white-crowned sparrows are adorable, though. Smiley face. Yeah, take care, you two. I really love your show.
Thank you, Holly. They are very cute. I'm looking out my window right now, and I see them hopping around through my vegetables that are in large planters out there. They've done pretty much the damage they're going to do at this point. I have 100% failed at peas this year because of white-crowned sparrows. At some point, when you do all the things I do, just like Holly did, of planting things for bird cover, encouraging wildlife, making places for birds all over your property.
And they take advantage of you.
They certainly do. And you know what? I can live without peas if that's what it comes down to. And they left all the cabbages and things like that alone. But it is extraordinarily exasperating how fast they do their damage. I was chatting with a gentleman who has been trying to seed cover crops. And he's done it twice. And he came in and bought them from me. And he came in a couple of days ago and said, I don't get this done. This is the third time. I'm just flustered because nothing's coming up. Said, well, you can join my special support group because I've been trying to seed an area in my backyard with a very slow growing fescue that I want to make into a ground cover. And it generally germinates very, very well. I've now seeded it 3 times since October, and I don't have a single blade of grass in this little 8x10 area. And I go out there and I look down, I don't even see the seed that I scattered. Even if I've covered it lightly, I don't even see the seed out there.
And you have made the largest feeder in the world. I mean, it's like acres, no, yards wide with all this lovely seed on it. Yeah.
If they want to go out in the acreage and eat seeds out there, that's absolutely fine with me. But I was looking out the window trying to think, how could they possibly do this much damage? You know, I don't see that many. Well, I took a quick picture and it came out pretty well of about 50. White-crowned sparrows flying off as a feral cat walked into the backyard as they were just finishing off my last batch of seed. So to answer his question for what to do about it, one, keep seeding. They'll find something else more interesting probably at some point. If it's
probably
really
not.
Yeah, me. But that's, yeah, somewhere between probably and probably not. Yeah, maybe is a better answer. Or cover it somehow. And by cover it, I mean what you have to do is really kind of a hassle, but you have to put netting or wire mesh over the area while you're waiting for the stuff to germinate somehow, and then remove it as fast as you can so the seedlings don't grow through it. You can top dress with compost, but they'll poke right through that compost. As far as they're concerned, that's just a minor inconvenience.
Okay, so a couple of things about white-crowned sparrows. One is that they are not the kind of birds like towhees that will, you know, grab a bunch of stuff and throw it in the air and look for things underneath it. So if you have straw on top, they probably won't go after the seeds because it's, you know, there's nothing to draw them in. The second is once you have created a giant feeder like that, they have good memories. They'll come back to the feeder and check out and see if there's any more seeds for them.
Oh, yes. So I can attest to that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the thing. Now, one of the things that Holly had in here was... Oh, so she said all of a sudden the bird population exploded. Yep. Well, when you put out a bird bath, you see the birds that have been bushes and you didn't notice that they were there. So that's one thing. Okay, so back to
I had a question from someone if you move the bird bath or the feeder across the yard to the other side of the yard, will you draw them away from your vegetable garden? And my answer was, give it a try and let us know how it goes.
Well, I will tell you that they will follow the water. Yes.
Yes.
They will notice where the new bird goes every once in a while to see if it's come back. Yep. But the seeds, these birds are, they're not intelligent like humans are, but they have memory. And so if you imagine if you were a bird out in the wild and there was this one bush that at certain time of year suddenly had food on it and then it went away and then it, but it came back every year. So wouldn't you remember where that bush was so you could check it out every once in a while to see if it had food on it for you? Evidently, of course you would.
Evidently
that and that's what, good. And they do that with you too. If I have a flock of white-crowned sparrows that used to come and I would feed them on the back patio outside my sliding glass door until the squirrels arrived a few years ago. Yeah. And so then I stopped. They still come back. Every time they come back for the winter, they come to my yard and they check out to see whether the seeds have come and there are seeds there. And there aren't. And so they wander off and go feed someplace else. But they have a long-term memory of where they got food previously. Okay, here's a thought for you. If you've got seed in grass seed and you know that the white-crowned sparrows are going to go and try and get it, how about putting out an occasional spray of a water spray so that it would come on and dampen the area and then go off and then come on a while later and dampen the area. They're not going to be attracted to wet seed. They much prefer dry seed. And if they're out there and the spray comes on, they'll certainly leave. They don't want to get wet. Right. I mean, that's not a bird bath. So what do you think about that idea? You could try that.
Sure. Give it a try and let us know how it goes.
The other thing to know is various birds are active. And these are day feeders.
Yes.
Feeding on the ground in the daytime.
That's a big part of why people don't see the problem. You know, if you work during, now people are at home more than they were, but they would work. Mm-hmm. They'd go out at the end of the day and find all their lettuce shredded. And they couldn't believe this charming little bird could possibly do that much damage. I said, well, it's the sheer numbers are the issue. When I'm looking at damage that people bring in, I look at the size and nature of the holes. It's really simple, typically, because it tells you something about the mouth parts of what caused that damage. Snails cause a characteristic type of damage. And yes, there's usually a shiny trail nearby, but not always. But they take bigger bites than, say, young caterpillars or earwigs do. And the birds tatter things. I mean, they just shred leaves. And ultimately, they get it down to where all that's left is the midrib. Once they come back next time, that'll be gone. So they also are very, this is the other thing, they tend to be way more methodical in terms of eating one species, at least my observation has been, until they're done with that one, then they move on to something else. So I had a whole bed of ranunculus years ago that was completely wiped out by them, and none of the other flowers nearby were damaged. They clearly had a strong preference for the young, tender shoots of ranunculus in my garden. It's been the peas this year, and I just thought, all right, well, you know, again, as I said before, I can live without peas. If they were doing damage across the spectrum to all the vegetables, I'd probably have to enclose things, which is another method of dealing with any kind of vertebrate pest. Conversation with someone yesterday who's getting frustrated because what appear to be tree rats are coming in eating her lemons one by one. So, well, you know, when you're talking about any vertebrate pest, and white-crowned sparrows, tree rats, squirrels are all in that category, animal pests, basically. For home gardeners, the simplest method that really works is exclusion. There's other things like, you know, killing them, which we don't really encourage, which doesn't work anyway, honestly, in terms of the sheer population. Repelling them, for the most part, almost any of these animals can get used to any kind of repellent after a while, although it may give some temporary relief. Finding their habitat, places that they're hiding, and with the tree rats in particular, that's very important. They want a safe place at night where they can sit in the crowded branches of your lemon tree and methodically eat the peel off of the lemon, which is the weird thing that they do, leaving the lemon hanging there without any peel on it. That's characteristic tree rat or roof rat damage. And they need to be in a sheltered place to do that. If it's up on the top of the tree, that's not going to be the one they go for. They're going to go for the one that's inside the tree where they can hang out, not exposed to the sky, not exposed to owls at night, and methodically take 20, 30 minutes to eat the peel off of your lemon and leave it hanging there. Someone brought me a picture last year of their Meyer lemon tree with 20 or more lemons hanging there without peels on them.
And they thought it was
interesting and mildly creepy, actually, to go out there and find that something had carefully peeled their lemons. What on earth could do this? And I said, I know exactly what would do that. A small obsessive animal that's hiding in one place and feels safe. And so the simplest thing that a home gardener can do, and this goes for white-crowned sparrows to some extent, clear out the places that they feel comfortable. Remove the shelter, remove the overgrown bushes nearby, or move your garden to the other side of the yard would be what I'll do for peas next year. Move them to the other side further away so they have to go out in the open to get to it. It works pretty well with white-crowned sparrows. It works pretty well with roof rats. Not so good with tree squirrels. They couldn't care less. I mean, I'm looking out my window right now and one's sitting on my fence and looking at me. I could walk out there and we could have a conversation practically. But the roof rats or tree rats and the sparrows are scared to be exposed for any significant period of time. Mm-hmm. They want to move rapidly back into where there's cover. And so oftentimes people will find if they do a good thorough yard cleanup right as the citrus is beginning to ripen, trimming the branches away from the fence, because these animals run along the fence, not along the ground, getting that overgrown area over in the corner, just cleaning it out, looking for nests, but that's not the typical issue. Mostly it's just places where they can harbor, move rapidly to another safe place, move rapidly to another safe place. You can actually get some pretty good control just by doing basically a yard cleanup in most cases.
And I like to have a messy yard because I really enjoy having lots of things out there. One thing to be aware of is roof rats, which is what we call them, are also known as, tree rats are known as roof rats.
Yeah.
And that's one of the places that they are notorious for nesting is inside your roof. So when you do your annual household check, you do an annual house check, don't you, to walk around the house and make sure that nothing's going on, like there's no termites and stuff? Mm-hmm. Well, when you do that, check up under the eaves to make sure there's no holes that have been chewed into those wooden bits and there are no rats in your attic.
Yeah, and actually a good pest control company will do that. So a lot of the same companies that provide services for termites and ants may well have training in what we call vertebrate pests and could come out and give you some guidance on the squirrels and the tree rats or roof rats. Probably not really expertise on the white-crowned sparrows. That's more of a garden issue. But again, exclusion is your simplest and best answer. I had a customer who built a raised vegetable planter. And in his neighborhood, there's a lot of tree squirrels. So when he put the posts in, he just left them tall on the corners. He left them, I think, 6 or 8 feet tall and made it possible, if necessary, and he's done it, to just go get wire or bird netting or whatever, cover over the whole garden without too much difficulty because he's got it framed up and ready to do that. And then a while back, we posted the picture of the customers who just built a PVC frame over their bed and draped it with frost blanket. Again, just physical barriers. That's probably the most comfortable way for most people to go because I don't think most people want to kill these cute little birds. They just want to share their food in a more equitable manner. Let's put it that way. Okay, next question.
So we are going to run out of time again. You know, we always do that. And so we'll just carry some of the questions over to another show. To have a question read on air and answered, feel free to send us a message to
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
All right. So the next one we had was, let's do this one. Dear Don and Lois, this is from James. Thanks as always for the wonderfully informative show. I have a topic that I'd love to hear more about if your plans for the show permit time. John Muir wrote about walking across the Central Valley and being unable to put down a foot without stepping on wildflowers. I was wondering whether you have any advice for native gardeners inspired by this vision of a bygone California on how to use wildflowers, which seem to get a lot less attention than native perennials. A few specific questions are, is interspersing annuals amongst bunch grasses a good idea? Can a home gardener create a successful vernal pool, and how might one set about doing that? In a garden with a spring ephemeral wildflowers, can you still use bark mulch, or is there any other weed-controlling strategies appropriate for an annual wildflower garden? Is it realistic to try to establish a area that can sustain itself with minimal intervention? Could you recommend some native wildflower species, annuals in particular, but not exclusively, that would be attractive to humans, be beneficial to arthropods, and or self-seeding successfully. Would direct seeding or growing in containers be more likely to lead to success, or is this a species-dependent thing? Thanks so much, signed James. Wow, lots of questions on that. That's going to have to be a long one, huh?
Well, we're going to break it up because I'm already working on a talk here as well as an article on the topic of California natives for the Central Valley or for the Sacramento Valley more specifically, because there's a big surge in popularity of California native plants right now. That's great. As a retail nursery owner, I love to see that. But there's also a lot of misconceptions about California native plants. We've talked about some of them on the air here. And the fact that something is native to somewhere in the political boundaries of California doesn't necessarily mean it works in our particular plant community here. We are in Davis, Woodland, Dixon, and other parts of the Sacramento Valley, a valley grassland plant community. The dominant species, if you were walking through here several hundred years ago, would have been bunch grasses, exactly what he's describing there. And they would have been interspersed with a whole lot of wildflowers. Mm-hmm. These are lower growing grasses than what dominate our hills and valley areas now. And this is one of the key issues. Maybe this will be what we talk about this time and then pick up some of these other questions for next week or the week after. Much of our state has been invaded by grasses that grow taller. And by things that are not grasses that grow taller. My farm, area where it rains and I don't do anything, I'll get oats, barley, and mustard vigorously. This year, they're going to be probably up to my shoulders because of that early rainfall that we got and the subsequent rainstorms that we got. Even with a week or two dry right now, those grasses out there and those mustard plants out there look great. And one more storm, they'll just take off. That's so tall that it shades out our native bunch grasses. So the native bunch grasses have diminished substantially in California, and that includes certainly here in the Central Valley and the Sacramento Valley. I do have about a half an acre on my farm that we realized shortly after we moved in was still native grasses. So we have worked very hard to conserve that with very careful timing of mowing, removal, and killing of non-native grasses, and it's an ongoing battle. So the key principle that I'll get into today is weed management, particularly these non-native grasses and the mustards, will be your biggest issue in getting a wildflower stand established, because all the wildflowers, California poppies, red maids, all those different lovely wildflowers that we have that would make those vast vistas of bright orange and bright red will be shaded heavily by those non-native grasses. So that's the first thing. I have found personally, and this may work for you in some other parts of California, that carefully timing my mowing encourages the native grasses and discourages the non-native grasses, because the native grasses bloom earlier. Those of you who are allergy sufferers and are allergic to grasses might like to know this. The native grasses on my property, and in this part at least, bloom earlier, set seed earlier, the seed ripens earlier. The non-native grasses bloom next, set seed later, and it ripens later. So if you mow before that seed has fallen and after the native grass seed has fallen, you'll be encouraging the populations of native grasses and discouraging the populations of non-native, or what are technically called adventive grasses. So that's one thing you can do. And there, of course, are herbicides you can use and mulching and smothering and hand pulling and goats and whatever you want to do to manage the types of weeds, essentially, that will otherwise dominate your planting. That's the first thing. The second is that direct seeding works great if you have open soil, but not if you have covered soil in general. The one thing that most people want is California poppies. As we say frequently on the show, that needs to be on open soil, not covered. Nothing wrong with putting it where it's covered. The seed will just lie there and wait to become uncovered. 10 years, 20 years, it doesn't care. But if you want it to grow and bloom this year, you scatter it where it is actually gets sunlight as it's germinating. Many seeds need light to germinate, and California poppies are in that category. So you'll need to get an area clean of weeds, clean of grasses especially. Go ahead and scatter the seed. October is typically the best time to do that. And once you get a stand of California poppies, they will dominate in all the areas on your farm, garden, property, whatever, where there is no competition for the seedlings. A good solid stand of poppy seedlings will crowd out a lot of things, but it won't crowd out mustard, it won't crowd out oats and barley and things like that. So you do have to be aware of those other things that are going to think you've created a great seed bed for them as well as the wildflowers. And that always ends up being the most challenging part of getting a stand of wildflowers established. I've had people who keep telling me, I thought poppies were so easy to grow. I throw the seeds out there. I've spent so much money on poppy seeds and I've thrown it out there and I don't have a single poppy plant. I said, well, That's good. You've got a lot of seed out there. At some point, the conditions may well favor it to germinate. Could be 5 years from now. But in that situation, and what I did to get it going on my properties, I do start them in pots first, actually, so that I can plant the little seedlings out where I know they're going to work. And I can nurture them, and I can pull the weeds away from those poor little tiny California poppy seedlings when they're half inch tall and looking so fragile. And once they're established, you'll have them well established. But it's sometimes getting those first couple ones going. It's easier to work from a plant that you literally buy at a garden center or start your own seed in a pot. So interspersing annuals among bunch grasses is not only a good strategy, it's exactly what you would have seen if you'd walked through here in the Sacramento Valley or the East Bay or places like that. Go to, or at least go to pictures or drone footage or something like that online of these beautiful areas that are still protected that have lots of California poppies. And if they zoom in close enough, you will see that it's not 100% poppies. It's poppies amongst bunch grasses. Our native bunch grasses, such as the ones I have on my farm, are a foot to a foot and a half tall. And the poppies hold their own with that, and blooms stand up above it, and it looks great. But if there's these non-native grasses beginning to come in and crowd them, they'll shade them out as the season goes along. They won't set as much seed, and the seed won't germinate well, because one of the things I do is I actually encourage, where I'm gardening, where I'm putting a vegetable garden or something like that, I encourage oats, barley, mustard, they're there, I don't care. And they make excellent biomass, and I just mow them down before they go to seed, and I just let the straw lie there and let it decompose over the course of a season. I've built fantastic soil this way just by using these non-native plants as cover crops. But be aware that they will shade out. I use them for this purpose. They'll shade out a lot of other things, weeds and, unfortunately, wildflowers. Creating a successful vernal pool is going to be challenging because it requires an impermeable soil layer. You can create a pool for sure. That's easy enough to do. You can make a pond with some sort of liner, something like that. You would need to be in an area where there is either very dense soil or a subsoil that's not permeable, or even a hard pan or something like that. So it's hard to create a vernal pool where one wouldn't already naturally occur, because it requires a unique soil condition. So that would be challenging. But you can plant many of the plants that grow around vernal pools are very, very successful plants in the valley for wildflowers. So looking into those types of things would certainly be a good way to go. As for the other questions here, spring ephemeral wildflowers, bark mulch, let's deal with those in another show, because I think it's really important to talk about how to plant California natives in the interior, and how to plant and which things are going to be successful. And I am constantly trying to steer people towards bunch grasses, wildflowers, and perennials, and away from the challenging woody native plants that have such a high failure rate in the landscape. So I think this is a great topic that'll segue into greater use of California native plants that are actually appropriate to your and our plant community. That's really the key thing. And I get into this discussion a lot with people who walk in and say, I'm looking for a hedge for privacy and I want a California native. Well, there's a couple I can recommend, but you wouldn't have seen any native hedge shrubs here in Davis if you were walking through here 500 years ago. So we're talking about plants that are native somewhere else in California, but you can certainly have bunch grasses, wildflowers, perennials, things like that. And of course, got to get a valley oak in there somewhere, because that's the tree you'd be standing in the shade of 500 years ago. Do you have room for a valley oak in your backyard? That's an important question to ask before you plant one. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.